This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Katie Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights on their ongoing case against military contractors.
These contractors are still trying to get away with the torture that they rained down on innocent people 10, 12 years ago. In fact, they want to have an even bigger role to play in America's military.
We also speak with distinguished international lawyer Peter Weiss on nuclear arms and North Korea.
The Belgian economist Ernest Mandel said shortly before he died that we're standing at the base of the Himalayas without adequate equipment, but we have to climb up. That's the situation that we're in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Heidi, I understand you were in court in Philadelphia last week. What were you doing there?
Well, Michael, there was an article on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer last week talking about a case that many feel should not be brought, and that is the case of 64-year-old Robert Sugar Bear Lark. He should have been released from prison back in 2007 when a federal court overturned his homicide conviction. There were many supporters in the courtroom. I think you've heard about Sugar Bear from our friend Francis Golden.
Sure.
Sugar Bear actually was on death row in an adjacent cell to Mumia's for many years in Pennsylvania. This was a highly irregular move. The district attorney is seeking the death penalty against Sugar Bear for a homicide that occurred nearly four decades ago. He had been incarcerated for that same period of time, has always claimed his innocence, and has had a spotless record in prison. If this murder had actually happened a few months earlier, Sugar Bear would not be facing capital punishment because the death penalty statute in that state had just gone into effect 3 months before the crime. And I was there with Johanna Fernandez, who's been on Law and Disorder a lot, talking about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. We were there for opening arguments. And basically, the defense did, we thought, an excellent job of reminding everyone that the many witnesses that the prosecution claimed they have were all actually individuals either with criminal records or having something that they could have in exchange forgiven by the DA's office. So their testimony, much like some of the witnesses who were coerced in Mumia's case and later recanted, in this case had a lot to gain from coming forward. And we also know history has shown, and the Department of Justice was actually investigating the Philadelphia Police Department during the period when this happened for corruption, saying that their actions, quote, shocked the conscience. And I think it's really critical that people are aware that this original homicide occurred when the police department in Philly was on the record as being highly corrupt.
So what's going to happen next?
Well, the trial is going to go on. It's expected to go on for 3 or 4 weeks. I think the prosecution will be calling many witnesses, a lot of police officers, some of these individuals who allegedly said that they were witnesses and identified Sugar Bear. The problem is that because the case is so old, many witnesses have died. And an unusual development is that even though the judge gave the jury a cautionary warning that they had to really look at the witnesses and judge for themselves their credibility and look at their facial expressions, the DA is going to be having actors, due to the number of people who have died, they're going to have actors sit in and read their testimony. So it kind of flies right in the face of the judge's instructions to judge for themselves the veracity of a lot of these witnesses.
Yeah, a case this old and this stale should be thrown out of court.
It should be thrown out of court. And the other issue is the case was overturned in 2007. So it's a last-ditch effort by the DA to impose the death penalty, which really hasn't been actually used in that state in decades. And it's costly, as you know, to bring such a case.
We'll keep our listeners updated on this latest death penalty development. Heidi, on another topic, I wanted to ask you about the black identity terrorist situation where the FBI is now has a list of people they want to spy on. Seems to me it's just an extension of COINTELPRO from the 60s, which they used to destroy the black movement and the rest of the left.
Exactly. They're calling it, the FBI is calling it the black identity terrorist threat assessment. And it really is in response to Black Lives Matter. They're defining it as individuals who resort to violence when they perceive racial injustice in this country. And I think that, as you say, it is COINTELPRO type tactics. And what it does is give fusion centers across the nation and law enforcement at all levels justification to engage in a different level of surveillance, possibly going undercover, penetrating social justice movements, especially related to racial issues in this country, and to possibly not only infiltrate but also serve as provocateurs to foment trouble.
Exactly. When people defend themselves, then they'll use that as what they say is violence as an excuse to go after them. Very troubling development.
Donald Trump told us during his presidential campaign that he was in favor of torture because, quote, it works. The Center for Constitutional Rights recently won a significant round in a case against a private military contractor, CACI, who had tortured three of its clients at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. When he was president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner maintained that if the torturers were not prosecuted, the practice of torture would be repeated. In fact, none of the architects of torture were ever held accountable in court. That is why this recent procedural victory by CCR in the case of Al-Shamari v. CACI is so important. Here to speak with us today is attorney Catherine Gallagher of the Center for Constitutional Rights. She played a key role in the Al-Shamari case. Katie Gallagher, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I do have to say at the start, this is my first time doing the show since Michael Ratner passed away. And so it is really wonderful to be here with you today. And it's always wonderful to hear his voice at the start and the end of the show.
Yes.
I worked closely with him. He was a mentor and continues to inspire us, including in the work I'm going to talk about today.
Thank you, Katie. We agree. In the CCR case against the private military contractor CACI, who were your clients?
Okay, this case that we have going on today, Al-Shamari v. CACI, is actually the third lawsuit that we've brought representing Iraqi former detainees against private military contractors. Our first case was filed in 2004, Saleh v. Titan, and in that case, which unfortunately we lost in a ruling of dated September 11th in 2009, on behalf of 252 clients, that case is unfortunately finished. We had a second case, Al-Qureishi versus L3. We settled that case on behalf of 71 individuals. This case, Al-Shamari v. CACI, is brought on behalf of four plaintiffs. But I do think it's important to remember there were many others beyond our four remaining plaintiffs who suffered serious abuses in detention centers across Iraq. And we've brought these cases and against private contractors. As we think back to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the wars in Afghanistan, which continue in some form to this day, there were many concerns and questions about why we went to war in Iraq. And part of that reason was profit. whether it was oil on the one hand, it also became a business. And so our former defendant, Titan, which became L3, they provided interpreters to the U.S. military and detention sites. Khaki, who remains our defendant in the current case, they provided interrogation services and were there in Abu Ghraib at the time of the notorious photos.
Katie, can you tell us, give us a sense of what kinds of things were done to the detainees?
Sure. This current case, on behalf of four, the plaintiffs are Taha, Assad, Suhail, and Salah. They were all Iraqi civilians. Three of them were randomly picked up during the house raids that went on, or the neighborhood raids when so many were brought into detention centers. Salah, the fourth plaintiff, was actually a journalist for Al Jazeera, and he was covering a explosion along the side of the road when he was arrested, and arguably arrested because he worked for Al Jazeera. They were all brought to that hard site in the fall of 2003, remained in that those two tiers again that we know from the photos. And in that time that they were detained, a series of physical harms happened to them. They were subjected repeatedly to physical assault, beatings, including on their genitals. Often there was a sexualized nature to the abuse they suffered. Extended, prolonged forced nudity. They were subject to extreme temperatures, deprived of food, forced to shower in front of men and women, in freezing conditions under ice-cold water. There was this scenario that we heard about from multiple former detainees where they had to stay under the cold water until they used an entire bar of soap, which sounds odd, but it was just something, again, being mocked through this this experience. They also, in some cases, were forced to watch the rape of a female detainee. One of our plaintiffs, Suhaila El-Shamari, the lead named plaintiff, he was subjected to a forced shaving, which again can sound like it's not so serious, but for him that was a really personal attack, and that was one that also was attack on his dignity and his religion. So those were the physical assaults. But I think in this case, which where we're bringing claims of torture and cruel and inhuman degrading treatment and war crimes, it's important to remember that torture also includes serious mental harm. The harms that I've just described happened in 2003, 2004, and here we are in 2017, and our plaintiffs are still suffering mental harm. When they were examined by the medical expert, they were found to all suffer from PTSD. I can tell you from even recent meetings this year with two of the plaintiffs, when they go back and have to talk about this, it is extremely, extremely disturbing for them. They often suffer from nightmares. Their interpersonal relationships have suffered. So that mental harm, where you don't necessarily leave marks, that has a lasting impact.
You mentioned we wanted to talk about what legal claims CCR made and what the theories are. You've just mentioned torture was one of them. Anything else?
Sure. Yeah, this case is brought under the Alien Tort Statute, which your listeners may be aware of. It's a statute that the Center for Constitutional Rights breathed new life into back in 1980 in the Filartica v. Peña Arala case, and particularly Peter Weiss and Rhonda Copeland. And this law allows for non-U.S. citizens to come into a U.S. court and assert a violation of international law. And here, what we're talking about are severe human rights violations. We're talking about violations of international criminal law. So indeed, it is torture, cruel and inhuman degrading treatment, and war crimes. And I would note that these acts are also criminalized under U.S. domestic law, and they are prohibited under U.S. military law. So that it is, these are prohibitions reflected not only at the international level, but they have been incorporated into U.S. law. And the U.S. has signed on to the Geneva Conventions. The U.S. has signed on to the Convention Against Torture. We have held ourselves out to the world as abiding by these prohibitions and these principles.
Attorney Katie Gallagher from the CCR, the Fourth Circuit ruled last fall that the political question doctrine did not bar your case. Why was this significant?
Sure, thank you. We've been litigating this case since I think May or June 2008. So we are about 9 years into litigation on behalf of these four individuals. And we have faced arguments, a range of defenses from CACI over the years of why this case shouldn't be in U.S. court. They have said that because they were contracted with the government, they should enjoy some of the immunity of the government, that it should somehow be a derivative immunity to them. They have raised arguments that because what happened at Abu Ghraib happened in the context of an armed conflict or an occupation, that somehow it's inappropriate to have tort law, essentially saying that there should be no law in war, which of course is flatly contrary to the Geneva Conventions and the fact that there is an entire body of law, international humanitarian law, to govern armed conflict. And one of the arguments that they've also consistently raised is that this case raises political questions, and it should be barred under the political question doctrine. Essentially, they've been arguing that in order to look at what happened at Abu Ghraib, you would have to be questioning U.S. government policies. And implicit in their argument is that torture was somehow legal, or that maybe they were authorized to commit torture at Abu Ghraib. And we have persevered, and we have won on this argument a number of times before. We've also most recently in 2014, the district court accepted it. So last October 2016, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals made a very decisive ruling on the political question issue. And it said that the military could never authorize torture because torture is illegal under U.S. law and international law, and that therefore there was no political question here. Torture cannot be a government policy. So the court reasserted and reaffirmed its role in determining what is the law and saying that, of course, its job was to apply the law. So what we have now is just looking at the facts of this case. Did CACI conspire to commit torture, war crimes, and cruel and inhuman degrading treatment against our plaintiffs? And I should note this ruling came out October 2016, so it came out prior to the results of the U.S. election. But back during that moment, this was when Donald Trump was saying, I'll bring back waterboarding, and a hell of a lot worse. So I think it was an important statement by the judiciary to remind anyone, and there's a concurrence that says explicitly, even the President of the United States cannot authorize torture. To have that statement from the third branch of the government at that time, and to see in the wake of some of the Trump administration policies a stronger judiciary than we were sometimes seeing during the Bush administration, is slightly heartening, somewhat heartening for sure.
Katie Gallagher, talk about the recent decision by Judge Brinkema that your detailed allegations of war crimes, torture, and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment can proceed against a private contractor.
Yes. After we had the ruling from the Fourth Circuit, the unanimous decision, the case was remanded back to the district court judge. And the judge that we had had on this case for many years, Judge Lee, he recused himself, and we were reassigned to Judge Brinkema, who has significant amount of experience in both alien tort statute cases and quote-unquote terrorism cases. So she has moved this case along at a good pace since we've been before her. And what she's made two decisive rulings. One was that the torture, war crimes, and cruel and inhuman degrading treatment satisfy a norm. They are recognized as international norms and thus are we are able to proceed under the Alien Tort Statute and notably, she said, including against corporations. That question is now before the Supreme Court in another case, but even with that petition pending, she made that affirmative ruling. And then she had us proceed to detail what happened to our clients, both what they suffered physically and what they suffered mentally, to determine whether the conduct done to them qualified as torture or cruel inhuman degrading treatment. And what's notable here is that in 9 years of litigation, this is the first time that we weren't talking in theoretical language about a legal doctrine. We were talking about the men who have brought this case and what they suffered. And when reviewing the evidence that we put forward, she found that indeed there was sufficient evidence to proceed on all three claims. And so we hope that finally we may be getting close to actually going to trial in this case.
Katie, this case is about privatization and the outsourcing of core governmental functions. Why is this case relevant today when the specific events it covers occurred back in 2003 and 2004?
Yeah. I think this case actually has even more importance at this moment, both on the torture front, which I've already mentioned, where we have a current president who has threatened to bring back torture, to remember that it is illegal, to be reminded that it cannot be a policy choice, and to remember that it happens to real people with real consequences. So on that side, this case is important. But we also have an entire Trump administration that wants to do privatization and outsourcing on steroids. It was bad enough during the Bush administration with Bush and Cheney and their friends. But here we have truly an entire administration. So this case can serve as a check and a reminder that there is accountability, that there are certain core governmental functions that shouldn't be outsourced. We shouldn't be having interrogation in war be something that is done for profit. We should not have interrogators who are trying to get, quote, actionable intelligence so that they can get a contract renewed. These are serious functions, and there needs to be a clear chain of command overseeing the interrogations. There needs to be a clear accountability under the U.S. Constitution, and you need to be serving the public interest, not the interest of your shareholders, when we're talking about something like detention. And I think this can carry over to immigration contexts, prison contracts, schools contexts. When we're talking about public functions and a public interest, it's wrong to be bringing shareholder interest into this.
Yeah, just to put a finer point on your point, Katie, I read last week that Donald Trump had met with Eric Prince. Eric Prince was the owner of the private contractor Blackwater, which has now changed its name. And Prince is possibly going to run for senator from Wyoming. Prince suggested to Trump that even more army and military jobs be privatized. I think he'd like to see the entire privatization of the armed forces. And Trump agreed with that. So this is a current, I won't even say problem, it's a current disaster. You can imagine you go from a drafted army of civilians to then a volunteer, really a poverty army, and now to a private army that makes a profit off of it. Then people in the United States have no control over what the military does in its name.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to add that you mentioned accountability, Katie, and one of the problems with private contracting is lack of transparency. So the public has no idea what they're doing, and then we can't hold them accountable.
Right, right. And both of those very important points. First, on Eric Prince, of course, Blackwater was responsible for the infamous Nisour Square shooting in September 2007. And CCR, with Michael and myself, we represented individuals who were injured during the Nisour Square attack or the families of some of those who were killed. And there was some measure of accountability with the Blackwater civil case. We brought it against the company and Eric Prince himself. Of course, when the U.S. Prosecuted the case, which I'm at least glad there was a prosecution. It was the prosecution of the shooters. It didn't go up the chain of command. And I think it's important to hold companies and their leaders responsible. And to see that Eric Prince has served as an advisor to Trump and has wanted to essentially outsource all of Afghanistan to his Hong Kong-based company is definitely disturbing. He has a track record that has left Iraqi civilians dead. There isn't a dispute about that. There were many questions also, even from the government oversight bodies, about his business practices and compliance with the law. To outsource Afghanistan this many years into the ongoing U.S. disaster of Afghanistan is the absolutely wrong answer. And what's notable, the news reports say that it was the U.S. military folks who talked Donald Trump out of following Eric Prince's outsourcing plan for Afghanistan. And I should note that in our cases against Khaki and certainly around Blackwater as well, the military has not generally been a fan of outsourcing. They know what comes from accountability gaps. They know what happens when you have people operating outside the chain of command. And when people don't comply clearly with the Geneva Conventions. So we have had retired military who have filed amicus briefs in our cases. And they also understand what happens when you have lawlessness in armed conflict. Of course, it can come back in down to American service members as well. So there are so many reasons why that is wrong. On the transparency side, there's a different set of work that my colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights have been involved in for a number of years, and that is a ongoing FOIA case that CCR is doing with Detention Watch Networks. And they are looking to get information about quote-unquote bed quotas in the detention context of private detention centers for immigration. They have one within the courts, and the government has been told it has to make pricing policies and contracts with the private prisons in the detention context available to the public, precisely for the point of transparency and accountability, Heidi, that you mentioned. And what was unusual in this case, to put it mildly, was that the two private companies, GEO Group and Corrections Corporation of America, which is now CoreCivic, they stepped in and intervened and tried to block this information from coming out. The U.S. government did not fight the decision from the judge in the FOIA case saying release the information. Government transparency is what FOIA is about. But the private companies tried to block the decision. Just last week, as they pushed their appeal all the way to the Supreme Court denied their petition of certiorari and essentially sent a message to the private contractors that you can intervene here. We have FOIA, we have government transparency and accountability requirements, and you cannot fully step into the shoes of the U.S. government.
Katie, Michael and I also wanted to ask you on a different topic, what kind of cases might the Center for Constitutional Rights get involved in regarding the catastrophic situation in the American colony of Puerto Rico?
Yes. CCR is very lucky that we have legal fellows who are working with us now. And one of our fellows, Stephanie Yanez, was down in Puerto Rico just last week, and she gave a report back to the staff yesterday. I can't have concrete ideas and of cases that we're going to bring, but the situation there is deeply concerning. And Stephanie echoed a lot of what Natasha Bannon, who you had on your show 2 weeks ago, she gave such an insightful interview with you. I would commend that to people to listen to. But we heard that is still, so many of the problems that she identified are still going on. And what Stephanie emphasized is that we have work to do here in the United States, the continental United States, in supporting Puerto Rico, and that includes pushing for a release of aid, calling for the repeal, the of the Jones Act. We know it was temporarily lifted, but only temporarily lifted.
10 days only.
Yes. So aid is sitting there in ports undelivered while people are in massive need of basic necessities. So real political pressure is needed to repeal the Jones Act. There needs to be a push to cancel the debt. We don't need reminders of how grateful everyone should be for the debt that the United States government in Washington has placed Puerto Rico in, and that there needs to be an end of the colonial condition. So I think there are political things that all of us can be doing, and in terms of specific legal actions or solidarity efforts that CCR can take, we will be looking to see how we can stand in solidarity. And in the interim, I think a number of us will be going out to a CLE that is being organized on Monday night at CUNY Law School for lawyers and non-lawyers to figure out how they can support the movement and also to follow PR on the Map, or go to PROnTheMap.com, both on Twitter and Facebook and the web.
Katie, we used to do regular updates with Michael Ratner on Guantanamo. Now, it's still up and running, despite promises that it would be closed. Can you give us a brief update on the situation?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Michael started the really important work of getting access to Guantanamo, to getting information out of Guantanamo, and that work began in the fall of 2001. And to know that we are here in the fall of 2017 and that 41 men remain in Guantanamo and that no one is talking about it, I don't think we thought we'd be there. To date, only 10 people have been charged, and there are some serious questions about the military commissions. I think they are reaching a crisis point. And then there are men who have been cleared for release. There are currently 5 men, including one CCR plaintiff, who has been cleared for release. So I think there will be a renewed push from CCR to the Trump administration to get people out of Guantanamo and to close down a system that is ultimately just unjust at its core.
Katie, about those 5 persons cleared for release, is one of the issues that they don't have a country to return to?
That's sometimes what we hear. Now, whether it's that the U.S. is unwilling to send people to countries, that the U.S. has also been unwilling, of course, to take people into the United States, it also has not been engaged diplomatically to find places for detainees to go. And it often will put very onerous conditions on states to take someone. So it's a combination of reasons, but it's an excuse to keep people detained without charge in unjust conditions.
Attorney Katie Gallagher, it's really been a pleasure to have your informed voice on Law and Disorder. How can people get in touch with the CCR and keep up with your good work?
People can go to our website, ccrjustice.org, and they can follow us on Twitter, @theCCR. Thanks so much for having me on.
Katie, it's always lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, 55 years ago, has the prospect of nuclear war seemed so frightening. President Donald Trump, who alone can commence a nuclear attack, has threatened North Korea with fire and fury and the total destruction of the country. North Korea has a population of 25 million people. Gabriel Sherman, writing recently in the magazine Vanity Fair, said that the situation with Trump has gotten so out of control that Trump's chief of staff, General John Kelly, and his Secretary of Defense, General Jim Mattis, have discussed ways to stop Trump should he order a nuclear attack. Obviously, the solution to winding down the escalating confrontation needs to be one of diplomacy. But when Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, the chief diplomat in America, attempted to do just that, President Trump said publicly that you are wasting your time. Here to speak with us today is the distinguished international lawyer Peter Weiss. He is the president emeritus of the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms and its U.S. affiliate, the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. Peter Weiss helped draft their October 10, 2017 statement, North Korea, Solution or Disaster. He was a founder of the Center for Constitutional Rights and served as its vice president.
Peter Weiss, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Peter, with respect to North Korea, what concrete diplomatic measures could be taken vis-a-vis nuclear weapons?
Well, I can give you a shopping list.
We'll take it.
Okay. First of all, there could be negotiations without preconditions. And that's really the most important one, because our precondition is that they have to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And everybody who knows anything about the North Korean situation knows that they're never going to agree to that. Other things that might be done would be the cessation of joint U.S.-South Korean maneuvers off the coast of North Korea in return for North Korea agreeing to stop further work on nuclear weapons. This is one of the solutions that Bill Perry, who went to North Korea as Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton, is now advocating very strongly. Another thing that might be done, of course, is the lifting or the reduction of sanctions. Another thing would be providing food and other humanitarian assistance to North Korea. And probably the most important thing that could be done would be a non-aggression pact between North Korea and the United States. In past history, non-aggression pacts have worked to stop wars from happening. And what are the main things happening here is, as I said before, the United States insists on North Korea saying we're going to give up our nuclear weapons. But if North Korea said we agree solemnly and under the monitoring of a neutral country not to attack the United States, and if the United States does the same thing in reverse, that could do a lot to prevent a nuclear war.
Now, Peter, speaking of that topic, how close do you think we are to either a nuclear or a conventional war between the U.S. and North Korea?
Well, considering who our president is right now and what our president is right now, I'm not going to say it on the air. We have to consider it as very close. Take this scenario, for instance. Let's say North Korea decides to launch either a nuclear weapon or a conventional weapon, either on Guam or in the water off Guam, what do you think Trump would do? Trump would say, okay, this is it. You know, I now have a justification for totally destroying North Korea. And that's a pretty frightening prospect. So this is not a time to say, oh, come on, you know, nobody's going to use nuclear weapons anymore. Because when people started saying that, they didn't realize what kind of an unstable and unpredictable president we were going to have.
Why have diplomatic efforts so far failed?
Well, they have failed because each time one side or the other, and sometimes both of them, decided not to comply with the terms that were agreed in the negotiations. If I can mention Bill Perry again, he had an op-ed piece not long ago where he described what happened when he went to North Korea, authorized and ordered to do so by Clinton in the year 2000. He and his colleagues working on that were very close to the kind of agreement that we wanted with North Korea. But it wasn't signed before the Bush administration came in. And when that happened, everything was off the table. So that was one of those situations. But there was something called the agreed framework agreement back in 1994, and that eventually collapsed. And in 2004, there was a joint six-party, six-country agreement. And in 2000, I think, four, it was, there was what came to be known as the Leap Day deal, because it was reached on a leap day. And that fell apart. As I said before, I think the main reason it always falls apart is that the North Koreans just don't trust us, even when we have a responsible government, more or less responsible. It says we're not interested in regime change in North Korea. But in real terms, the desire of the United States for regime change in North Korea has been there for the last 50 years. And that's, I think, what leads to North Korea acting as they are.
Peter, I'm right in saying this, aren't I, that in the United States, only Trump is the person who's authorized to launch a nuclear weapon. And my question to you, are there any controls over him?
None that I'm aware of. I certainly hope there are some controls. But if you look at it simply in terms of U.S. law, the president can start a war and nobody can stop him. But of course, in the Constitution, there is a little known clause that says Congress shall declare war. So, in principle, he should not be able to start a war. But when you talk to people who are familiar with how the Defense Department operates, they will tell you, no, there's nothing that we can do to stop the president. But I don't think, or rather, I'm convinced as an international lawyer that under international law, it would be prohibited for Trump to start a nuclear war, because a nuclear war would violate the fundamental principle of international humanitarian law, also called sometimes the law of conflict, which holds that it is illegal to use a weapon that fails to discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. And of course, the nuclear weapon could never pass that test. But we don't have anybody in Washington who's interested in paying any attention to international law, or for that matter, to the clause in the Constitution that I just mentioned.
Peter, the United States is one of nine countries that possess nuclear weapons, and it's the only country to ever use them twice, against the two Japanese cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in 1945. Can you talk a bit about the effect of an atomic bomb in terms of blast, heat, and radiation?
Let me give you a short answer. I don't think you want a lot of numbers here now, but let me give you this totally horrifying fact. It is estimated that if India and Pakistan engage in a nuclear war, 2 billion people might starve because of the effect that it would have on the production of food throughout the world. Is that good enough for you?
Sadly, yeah, yes.
More than good enough. Yeah. Right? What is the size of the U.S. nuclear arsenal and North Korea's?
We have, according to the latest figures I've seen, 9,400 nuclear weapons on alert and another 4,000 or so in reserve. In other words, the extra 4,000 would take maybe 30 minutes to make operational, whereas the close to 10,000 are operational now. North Korea has somewhere between 7 and 9. It's difficult to know exactly how many they have.
What is the 1968 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and who are its signatories?
The Non-Proliferation Treaty really should have been called the Nuclear Weapons Abolition Treaty. But because of the pressure of the nuclear-armed states, in particular the five which incidentally also happen to be the five that have a veto power in the United States, that's the U.S., Russia, France, and China, because of their pressure, they didn't put abolition in the title of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So the treaty is generally thought of as simply a risk reduction treaty. We don't want to make nuclear weapons available to countries that don't have them now. But to those of us who are abolitionists when it comes to nuclear weapons, the most important paragraph in the Non-Proliferation Treaty is the one that says that there is a general obligation to move toward a complete nuclear weapons-free world under international controls.
But there are countries that haven't signed it, aren't there?
Well, there's a country that unsigned it, and that's North Korea. There's a country that never signed it, that's Israel. It is the treaty which has the largest number of signatories of any treaty currently in effect. So it's just about everybody.
So what happened to it?
can't say that it's a bad thing not to have nuclear weapons proliferating. So it has had that positive effect that a number of countries that were toying with the idea of developing nuclear weapons have failed to do so because they didn't want to be subjected to sanctions and so forth. So that's the positive. The negative is that the paragraph mandating the destruction of all nuclear arsenals, that paragraph has never been implemented by any nuclear-armed country.
Peter, is there a court that has jurisdiction over the nuclear powers?
In principle, yes. It's the International Court of Justice. About 2 or 3 years ago, a case was brought in the International Court of Justice, which is the highest court on questions of international law, sitting in The Hague, Netherlands. The case was brought by one of the smallest countries in the world, the Marshall Islands, but a country that was very familiar with the nuclear problem because something like 40 or 50 tests were set off in the Marshall Islands after the end of World War II to test and to do research on the effects of nuclear weapons, with, of course, terrible consequences for the people of the Marshall Islands. And I think they deserve a great deal of commendation from the rest of the world. I always think of them in terms of the movie that was called The Mouse That Roared. And they did roar. They were a mouse. And that case was based on precisely on that paragraph in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which we were talking about a few seconds ago. And the Marshall Islands were saying, get with it, you know, implement that paragraph, because we don't want to see another nuclear war. That case actually got a little bit into being considered by the International Court of Justice. They didn't immediately issue what the nuclear-armed states wanted, what we would call in American judicial language a motion to dismiss. They didn't dismiss it originally. But then eventually they did dismiss it on the ground of what we would call lack of standing. In other words, they were saying, you know, come back and see us after the nuclear war has started, but you haven't shown to us that it's about to start, and therefore we can't rule on this question.
The International Court of Justice mandated in 1996 that states must commence and conclude negotiations for the global prohibition and elimination of nuclear warfare. Can it enforce that mandate?
Did anybody enforce that mandate?
Or can it?
No. No country possessing nuclear weapons has complied with that mandate.
So how would you weigh the efficacy of international law and the lawyers that try to enforce it in terms of curbing a nuclear disaster?
Well, one way to answer your question is look at the number of countries that signed on to the nuclear weapons, what is called colloquially the Ban Treaty, which was signed at the United Nations on July 7 of this year. That treaty, of course, was adopted Well, it was adopted by the vote of 122 countries. And some of us working on nuclear abolition were originally not too happy about it because it sounded as if these 122 countries were saying, we want nuclear weapons abolished, but until the treaty goes into effect for the five nuclear weapons countries, nuclear weapons are legal. Now, none of the governments that signed it said that in so many words, but the nuclear weapons countries said, we can ignore that because we're not going to sign it. And the fact that none of them have signed it, of course, makes the treaty a rather weak instrument as of now. But if you look at it in terms of a step-by-step procedure to what eventually may be a total ban of nuclear weapons, it was a very important thing. And the people who advocated for it really did a great job in mobilizing public opinion for it. And we are, by we, I mean the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Weapons and its U.S. affiliate, are now quite happy with the text of the treaty because it incorporates all the arguments for the existing illegality of nuclear weapons that we have been advocating for about 30 years. So there's a nice paragraph in the preamble which begins with the words, basing ourselves on, this is the government speaking, and so they're saying, basing ourselves on norms of international humanitarian law, which is the law of war, the law of warfare, basing ourselves on human rights norms and a whole other references to international law that are very good. They are part of the treaty now, so we are not on the same page with everybody in the abolition movement.
Peter Weiss, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but before we have to say goodbye to you, could you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your organization and suggest what they might be able to do?
Well, I think probably right now the most important thing that they could do is get in touch with all of their members of Congress and say, for God's sake, do something to create a barrier to the president acting alone to start a nuclear war. But if you want information, you can go to www.lcnp.org. LCNP stands for Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. And you'll find a lot of interesting stuff there. On the question you asked earlier, Michael, about the consequences of a nuclear war, the organization that has very complete information on that is Physicians for Social Responsibility. So if you search PSR nuclear weapons, you'll have all of that information there.
Peter Weiss, it's really a privilege to have you on Law and Disorder, and we will urge our listeners to call their representatives because we're in a potentially dire situation here.
You said it.
Peter, thank you so much. You take it easy.
Okay.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.